Today is August 7th, 2015. My name is Christina Barrow Macklin, interviewing for Arizona State University, dinner 2440. I'm asking you to, interviewing Mr. Arnett Duncan.
Arnett.
Duncan, can you spell your first name?
Sure, it's A-R-N-O-T-T.
Okay.
And Duncan is D-U-N-C-A-N.
Thank you. And then could I ask you to say your title as well and the organization that you work for, Borough?
So I work with a lot of really neat people at Duncan Family Farms, just west of Phoenix, about 30 miles west of Phoenix, in Goodyear, Arizona.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your background and how your family got into farming.
Okay. So my biological father passed when I was 4 or 5. My mom remarried when I was 8 or 9. And so my dad, since I was young enough, my stepfather is my dad. So he is the third generation farmer. His family actually homesteaded in Arizona, the southwest corner of what is now 7th Avenue and Southern in South Phoenix. And so I grew up as a little kid going out to the farm, you know, all summers, weekends, holidays, really any time that we were needed, and we were pretty much needed all the time. And I just loved it. Back then the farm was that classic Central Arizona cotton, you know, forages, cereal grains, and, an odd little seed variety here or there that you would try. But for the most part, we didn't do any vegetables. My dad did a few watermelons here and there because that's kind of what he grew up doing when he was in high school. Our first foray into vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables, was watermelons. And so my dad came by that, you know, years ago when he was in high school. When all the men went off to war, World War II, there weren't enough guys around to harvest. And so he organized his high school buddies, mostly football players, and they went and harvested watermelons. And so that just stuck with my dad. And so, he grew melons for decades.
So tell me what it was about the farm and going out and working it, and what, well, you enjoyed it, but also, you know, kind of, you were young and it was hot and it's hard. Can you explain kind of?
You know, it's funny. Looking back, you know, if you looked at what we did today, looking back, given today's regulations, present age, obviously, you know, now that I'm in my late 50s, you know, I look back on what we did and just am amazed at some of the things that we did. And you just learn so much from being out on the farm frequently on your own with, you know, you with your, I was with my brother and my cousins. We're all about the same age. And, you know, our first jobs on the farm were basically cutting weeds, digging ditches, you know, the romantic part of farming. And it was just, you know, but lunchtimes and of course any of our breaks that we would take, we probably weren't tired. We just wanted to play. But we took breaks and sometimes, you know, if the lizard got away from you, it took a lot longer to take that break than another one. But, we had fun out on the farm. We learned to drive, we learned to drive tractors first. We learned to drive tractors before we could reach the pedals. And it wasn't as necessary to reach the pedals. My dad would just move the seat back on the tractor. There was a hand clutch on the John Deere tractor. And so you could kind of scoot around to hit the brake on the left side while you were working the clutch with your hand. And so you learn to do things and become, I guess, self-supporting. I guess it's a pretty good place to just learn how to do things. And in doing that, things that we thought were just average every day, friends that we went to school with, because I grew up in downtown Phoenix. You know, when I was a young guy, we were we lived on about 32nd Street in Oak. And so we just drove out to the farm. It was just fun growing up on the farm. The things that we did that our buddies downtown, you know, just were amazed that we could drive, you know. And I started driving cars and trucks when I was a little guy too, you know, and really trying to get, you know, to the pedals and everything. There were times when, you know, the old thick telephone book came into play frequently. So anyway, it was fun. And then on top of just being a kid out on a farm without a lot of rules, there was this attraction to the outdoors. And I couldn't put my finger on it. Even when I got into college, I didn't know then, my first year in college, you know, I was always attracted to the natural sciences in high school. I didn't have that opportunity to do the 4-H or FFA. I went to Catholic grade schools. I went to Brophy Prep. So, you know, when buddies in agriculture would say, "Hey, remember in FFA when we did this?" And it's like, "Yeah, no, I don't." But I always enjoyed the natural sciences. And when I got to my freshman year at the University of Arizona in Tucson, I wanted to be in agriculture. I wanted to be working outside. Here we sit in my office, but this isn't the place that brings me joy. It's walking fields. It's being out, working the land, I guess. And it's just, it's kind of funny when people ask me today, "What are you going to do? When are you going to retire?" And you know, I think classic farmers don't. I don't know that we ever retire, really. You know, you just slow down a little bit, but. My answer is kind of a patent, just a, you know, I see myself as an agronomic consultant to my own company after I get out of everybody's way, you know, because there are these guys that are coming up in the company are so sharp, they're dedicated, they come preloaded with so much really cool information, that, yeah, at some point in time, I'll be getting out of their way and just hopefully still able to contribute at a level. And I know I'll always be able to enjoy the farm. So, you know, hopefully they'll be patient with me and let me hang around.
So let's talk a little bit about the work ethic you learned working on the farm and growing up on the farm. Kind of how has that played a role in your life today?
Wow. You learn that hard work is just what everybody should do. You know, it's just, hard work isn't that difficult. If when you do it every day, it's just not that difficult. And then when you see today, to this day, I have a respect for people who work hard, who actually appreciate the art of agriculture or plumbing or electronics or carpentry or whatever it is. There's an artistry to that, and I appreciate that at every level. And to this day, you know, we have wonderful people that we get to work with, you know, at an entry level position on the farm, and I like to go around and go out and sometimes, like over in the California, one of the California farms, we have rocks everywhere. We had to pick up rocks because they were literally killing the equipment. And the only way we could do that, at that point in time anyway, was literally just walk out with our hands and pick them up and throw them in a trailer. And so I remember going by, still to this day, whenever I see a rock crew, you know, I want to go out, walk out and shake their hands and say, "Thank you for doing this. I know this is a... this is a hellish task. Thanks for doing this." And they're looking at me like, "Hey, what are you talking about? This is what we do. You know, you're paying us to do this. We do this. You know, we're good." And I just want them to know, no, I appreciate you being here. You can do anything for this price. You can do anything anywhere. And I just want you to know that I appreciate you doing this here today. And I'm sure that as I'm driving off, they're going, "So who was that guy anyway?" And But it just gives you an appreciation for the value of what everybody does. So, hard work is hard work. I have to tell you a story. My older son went to work with his uncle for a couple of weeks in a large food service venue, a country club of some sort. And so, Kel was kind of interested in that industry at the time, and so his uncle said, "Hey, come on out, take a look at it, see what you think." So, I'm sure he probably started washing dishes, bussing tables here and there, just doing what anybody can do, just stepping off the street. And so he'd go in early in the morning and, work his hours, clean up from the night before, whatever that looked like. And I'll never forget that he called me up the next day after work and he said, "Hey, I talked to my brother-in-law, his uncle." He called me up and he said, "Hey, I want to share with you an interaction that one of my supervisors just had with Cal." He said, "You'll get a kick out of this." So so he goes on to explain that Cal had come in early, worked all morning, stayed a little later to kind of help prep for something, and then they had a few people not show up for what was a large gala event that night. And so they looked at Cal, the supervisor looks at Cal and just says, "Cal, would you even consider, helping serve tonight?" And he said, "Sure. Just point to where I go, what I do, and sure, I'll do it." And so they gave him his white coat and gloves or whatever it was. And he stays that night late into the evening and works all night, helps clean up, and then shows up early the next day, which by that time is probably maybe 4 hours later or something. Shows up to work and starts doing what he normally does. And the supervisor came in, made a point of coming in to mention to my brother-in-law that Kel, that when she went to Kel to say, "Wow, that was incredible. I mean, the fact that you literally worked all day was just amazing." And what the report from my brother-in-law was, so Kel right off the bat looks at her and says, "Oh wait, you think that was hard work? Oh no. Harvesting, packing watermelons at 113 degrees, for 8.5 to 10.5 hours a day, that's work. This, I can do this all the time." So if that gives you an indication as to, the level of appreciation that you have in just learning how to work hard, I think Kel explained it pretty well.
He absolutely did. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of the...
And so you get an idea that I don't have a problem telling you things. In fact, you're going to have to shut me up when I get into the story.
I'm not going to. So I have as much time as you do today. So my schedule's open. And it's a great story. So that's perfect. Tell me a little bit about the harvesting of the vegetables and the family dinner table and what that was like, kind of that interaction between your family and cooking.
So... Interestingly, when the boys were little, I have two boys, 2.5 boys. The half is that, because I know you're thinking, "Well, what is that?" The half is a young man. Young man came to us when he was 14 or 15, his freshman year in high school. He was on the freshman basketball team with my younger son, Sean. And, his, for lack of a better definition, his family, his home situation kind of imploded. And so, actually maybe exploded. So he didn't have anywhere to go. So my younger son invited him to come home and spend the night and, get dinner or whatever. And so, he came over and we got to meet. Javier is the young man's name. And so we got to meet Javi, and so basketball starts, and Kathleen's bring in obviously, you know, the freshman team, they get to go last. They're last. They're low on the totem, or yeah, they're low on the totem pole. So anyway, Kathleen goes to take Hav home one night, and there's just police caution tape around the entire house. And make a long story short, there was his most of his family was in jail, and his younger sister had been taken away. He had no idea where, but there was no one to talk to. The neighbors just said everybody's gone. And so Javi spent the night. And so we washed his clothes, got him a toothbrush, and he was good to go to school the next day. But he couldn't find anything out about where he was supposed to go, stay, whatever. Everybody was in jail. So he spent the night again. And then he spent another night. And then he spent another night. And, you know, my wife Kathleen, who is, let me just say this, it's always better to really marry well. She is absolutely the better half. She took Javi out and just said, you know, would it be easier to stay with us if you had a little bit of clothing? Because he couldn't get any clothing. The house was shut down. So we bought some clothes, probably got some deodorant, some, you know, whatever else those guys need when they're freshmen in high school, we got that stuff. And so the half started, and so we have 2.5 boys. But anyway, when the original two, Cal and Sean, were little guys, we decided to open the farm up to the public, and that was in the early 90s. And so you talk about dinner around the table, and so it was really fun, you know, to have the boys out on the farm, right? Because they're little guys, and they're cruising around on the farm, and they were catching toads and chasing lizards and all the stuff that I did, and they were having a ball. But I'll never forget our younger son, who was, two something. And Kathleen had gone to get a pizza, and she pulls down the tailgate of the truck, and you know, we dive into our juice and pizza, and Sean says, "Mom, are we ever going to have dinner at our table again?" And she looks at me. I almost half choked on the pizza, and it was like, okay, so we might be spending a little too much time at the farm here. How do we back off? And so we just, you know, we made a point of starting to have dinner time and making a point of you know, not sitting in front of the TV, but sitting down with each other at the same table and having dinner. And what was really interesting is I enjoy those moments so much that and it's a joke in the family that I put my fork down, maybe take a drink of milk or water or whatever, and I just sit and kind of look around the table and just sort of take it all in. And so Sean, the same younger son, same guy, says, "You know, Pops, it's a little creepy that you just put your fork down and kind of just stare at us for a little bit." He said, "I get it. It's kind of cool. You're just enjoying the moment. But it's a little creepy." And so after we all stopped laughing, I just said, "I absolutely love these moments. And you're right. I would just freeze this right now if I could. You know, and I'd look at those guys and just say, I'd like to freeze you right where you're at too, because this, you guys are just so fun all the time." And they're just like, they just hit you, you know, and just go, yeah, right, Pops. So dinner was just time with family, you know. So breakfast and dinner, I didn't have lunch with them. And I got to the point where I'd start to go into work just a little bit later, just so that I could have breakfast with them before they went to school, so that I could see them twice a day. I'd get to see them in the morning and get to see them at night. And I'd stay at work a little bit later, but I'd still get them at night and in the day. And to me, that was twice as much time. And I think it was the same with them. But I'll never know because I'm not going to ask him. But to me, it was a significant thing.
What do you think happens at the dinner table that makes it so important? It makes you enjoy those moments so much?
Stories about what you did during the day. And you know, for us, I got to tell you know, when they were that age, it wasn't so much about the preparation of the food or anything. And oh my God, and when they got older, it definitely was not about the preparation of the food, because as they grew, they're 6'5 and 6'4, Javi's 6 or 6'1, and their friends, we had the you know, the Kool-Aid house, if you will, so all their friends, and we loved it. We wanted to have that house where everybody came, you know, we wanted the house that everybody came to, because we loved knowing what they were up to, you know, and just enjoyed that time with them so much. But honestly, I'll never forget Kathleen running back into the back room one time, just going, "You got to come out and help me." She's going, "I literally cannot prepare food fast enough to get in front of these guys. I just they're starving. You know, there's no chunks out of the furniture yet, but you know, you got to give me a hand here. The microwave isn't fast enough." So I went out and here's, you know, part of the basketball team, some guys from the baseball team, football team, and they're all big. They're all big guys. And they were just tearing through the food. And so I have to admit that, you know, when in their formative ages, shall we say, they probably weren't eating the best stuff around. Just massive quantities of it, you know, as they're tearing through, you know, huge numbers of calories every day as they're lifting in the morning, running, and then, you know, open gym or whatever the season, you know, looked like. So, yeah, we were just trying to keep those guys, you know, full. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I digress.
No, it's great, it's perfect.
So today, let me share with you, today is so funny because just the other day, so now, you know, especially when we're in season here in Arizona, you know, now it's you know, I harvest things and I take them home and you know, we juice a lot. The boys juice. They love doing the juicing thing. We do a lot of juicing for breakfast and even to drink with lunch and maybe dinner. But, you know, for Kathleen and I, dinner is a large bowl of salad with different ingredients. But then the entree, you know, fish, chicken usually, will be on top. And that's dinner. And then we usually eat out of the same bowl, you know, handing it back and forth and carrying on conversations about what she's doing, what I'm doing, what the boys are doing, and you know, visiting about friends and just that's dinner. But it's basically a salad with something on top. And that just seems very natural to us. But I can't remember which one of our boys it was. I think it was Sean was over the other day. And he's looking, kind of rummaging through the refrigerator really quick, and he's going, "Mom, you don't have anything to eat in here. The only thing I see is there's just ingredients." And so we just loved that statement so much, because, you know, and yet he enjoys good healthy meals with us, but at that moment he just wanted that thing to throw in the microwave. Because he had a short period of time, and you know, to have lunch or whatever it was, he needed to get going. So anyway, that's dinner for us, or those are meals. Meals have been, you know, I guess just whenever, whatever time we can get to hang out with each other.
What made you decide to go into the family business, and at what point did you make that decision, do you think?
Oh, I just knew, like I said, well, early on in my academic life, I just knew I wanted to be outside. It was pretty quickly that I transferred that interest of just being outdoors to really wanting to learn about agronomy. So I got my degree in agronomy and plant genetics. I graduated in the early 80s and just went out to the farm, the family farm, and so started working in the family farm and doing that classic Central Arizona, you know, row crop configuration. But there were signals to me that I picked up. I studied. I had the opportunity to study some, you know, the sale of commodities. So I studied the commodity market. I actually, you know, bought some futures. You know, and with my dad's blessing, and we went in together and we bought and sold cotton, so that I could learn how to buy and sell cotton, how to market more efficiently. Because, you know, the easiest thing sometimes in the fresh fruit and vegetable, any crop that you're growing, any part of agriculture, the easiest thing to do is to produce. The most challenging is to market. And so I wanted to learn this thing about cotton marketing. And so it just happened to be at a time in the marketing, in the overall distribution of cotton as a global commodity. It was just shifting from a domestically grown, domestically used commodity to global. And so for the first time, for an example, you'd see a massive hailstorm go through, you know, the cotton belt, and the market didn't budge. And it was earth-shaking. You know, it was, everybody in the room was looking at the reports of potential damage to the cotton crop, and yet there was no movement in the cotton market, in the futures market. What in the world was going on? Unbeknownst to us growers, there were reports that other countries had the ability and wanted to move cotton into the world market. So the world marketers, the world buyers of cotton, took that into consideration. So market didn't budge. The inventory was now out there. And the United States inventory of cotton was just one of many. And so at that point, you start to realize, you know, my immediate reaction was to look at the price of cotton that day and just go, wait, that means we're going to have to grow cotton for this amount? That's not going to happen. So then you realize as a commodity grower that now you're farming the government. And now you play to the whims of the, not to say that it's the whims, but that's the first word that comes to mind, of the federal government. And so trying to figure out what you're doing every other year, or at the very least every 5 years, extremely challenging. And not only that, I'm a farmer, I like growing crops. I don't want to have to farm the government. That's not what I do. That's not what I get enjoyment out of. So that changed how I looked at farming. It changed how I looked at marketing. So I wanted to get into crops that could stand on their own, where I could put a budget together. And so, by the way, you ought to know that around here we use a lot of sports analogies. So we use the, you know, if you're batting in baseball and you step up and, you know, there's an average of a certain number of certainly strikeouts, walks, singles, doubles, triples, home runs. You know, if you're putting a budget together and it requires you to hit a double or a triple every time you step up to the plate, man, those are tough odds, like almost impossible. But yet that's what we're looking at. So then how do we make money without the government stepping in and saying, oh, hey, let me carry that ball for you and throw it a little further into the field? That was tough. So I wanted to get into something that would allow me to be profitable. And so I really wanted to get into more of the fresh fruits and vegetables. And so we started to do that. And it was right about that time when we first started into, we as a family, my dad, my brothers, we all farmed together at one point in my dad's company, Agricultural Enterprises. And so it was actually right around that time when we realized that we just had very different, we being myself and my brothers and my dad, just had different ways of farming. And what was important to me was maybe not as important to them. And so, you know, with everybody's blessing, Kathleen and I kind of broke off and did our own thing. And so it was sort of a slow, it was a transition that took place in the mid 80s and finished in the late 80s, around 88. And so we started our own farm. And sometimes it's just better to be lucky than good. And we grew mostly vegetables, still growing a little bit of cotton at that time. But we did well enough to keep going. And there were some extremely slim years. There were times when I'd go home and Kathleen and I would grab the boys and we'd look at them and just say, listen, guys, here's where we're at. And to look at really young faces, and to try and let them know that, you know, listen, it's not all lost or anything, but we're going to have to be tight here, you know. So when your buddies come and they've got a new skateboard and you're not able to get one, here's what's up. Here's what's going on. So they learned. They learned early on. You know, you save when you can, and when you'd hit a home run and you'd have a good melon crop or broccoli or whatever potato, whatever that crop might have been, you save it and you wait and you hold on to that and you learn to be conservative. And I think learning to farm on my own during a period when Central Arizona agriculture was not really swinging from the trees so much. It was very difficult. If you could make it at that time, I think you could make it anywhere. And so we learned to farm in those times. And so you really learned to save and budget and be conservative, fiscally conservative. So anyway, so now I've been taking off. What was the original question?
No, that's perfect. So I'm going to follow up with a question about the decision to split up. I mean, what was that impact for you? I mean, personally, I mean, it must have been one of the hardest decisions you made. And how did you make that decision?
Oh, it was really interesting. I'm kind of a systems guy. We also joke about a fairly healthy level of OCD in my family with me, and so there's a lot of funny jokes about that, and I wear that badge somewhat proudly, so I'm good with it. At the very least, I'm good with it. Because because at the end of the day, when you're in agriculture, I don't know that having a healthy amount of OCD doesn't help you. You know, pay attention to detail. To create systems of efficiency that help everybody, you know, work together more efficiently and so that you can work smarter and not harder, because that at the end of the day I think is what has helped us kind of move forward a little bit. So the decision was Kathleen and I went to have dinner with my folks and I had an idea. So I wanted to meet with my dad, with my parents in general, knowing that there was a chance that this could go, you know, one of two ways. And one was that he would like the idea and move forward with. And the idea was, here's how we can organize this farm so that the brothers aren't overlapping and yet not dropping the ball or creating gaps in between us. So here's how we can organize this so that here's how the... literally an organizational chart, flow of personnel, flow of equipment, you know, and I thought I had laid out pretty well, you know, and actually my dad did too. He looked at it and he said, yeah, that'd be great if I wanted to do that. But he just looked at me, he looked at both Kathleen and I, and he said, I have never wanted you guys to farm together. Never wanted you. That would be the worst idea in the world for you guys to farm together. Because unbeknownst to me, he and his family had tried that, and it didn't work very well. And he didn't want to create that situation that threw us all into the same bucket and tight work environment. He just thought, I'm not going to do that to you. So he just said, I just have always wanted to create an opportunity for you guys to get in here, learn, and then go and do your own thing. And so I'm looking at him going, I guess it's time for me to go do my own thing. You know, and Kathleen kind of grabs my leg, and my mom starts crying, and I just said, great. I didn't know that. You know, we might have started a transition a little bit earlier so that it wouldn't be just, hey, tomorrow I'm going to go out and start my own thing now. But no, it was great. With their blessing, Kathleen and I, you know, literally jumped off the cliff together, holding, you know, each other's hand. And we joke about those things, not that moment per se, but I have to say, after that, you know, holidays and dinners with my family became a lot more fun because we weren't, you know, grinding about the farm and what was supposed to have happened that day or did happen or whatever. And so it became less about work and all about family stuff again. So it was good. It was great. And Kathleen and I still joke about the amount of work because her thought was, you know, that was a big place. And when I got out of school, you know, I thought I'd be able to come in and just turn the agricultural world on its ear, you know, because, hey, I know how to do this stuff, right? And I guess it's good to have self-confidence, but still, that was ridiculous thinking. Because I get out of school and I could have worked, you know, I could have worked 30 hours a day and that farm could have absorbed every last minute of that. And as I later found out. But when I started, when Kathleen and I were doing our own, you work just as hard, if not harder, but it feels different. It's just different when it's your place. And I think any business owner, any entrepreneur would feel that. Not that I'm an entrepreneur, any individual business owner would feel that when it's your place. There's just a different feeling about it. It just feels right. It feels good. And so you know that every last minute that you put into it is benefiting you and your family and the people that you get to work with, hopefully. And so it's just gotta, I don't know, just, you don't get tired. You get physically tired, but you don't get emotionally tired.
So you mentioned that you weren't an entrepreneur, however you have to manage the business, you have to market, you have to produce. So in some ways you are an entrepreneur in your own right.
Oh, I know, I joke about that, okay. Though. I jokingly go with the motto of, you know, it's better to be lucky than good. And I just think that I've been incredibly lucky in my life.
Do you think your business skills helped you manage and kind of transform the farm itself?
I wouldn't really call myself a great businessman. I think there's a certain amount of logic that goes forward. There's a certain amount of, remember the respect for people? Having a certain level of respect for the people that you work with will get you, you can create good teams, and we had really good teams, still do.
So let's talk a little bit about choosing to start on your own, the crops you chose, why you chose them.
So we chose to go into fresh fruits and vegetables as much as possible, although ironically enough, at the time that we broke away, financing, the financial institutions were set up and organized so much around the guarantee that the government throws, you know, that safety net underneath the commodities, that you could borrow money all day long to grow cotton and the whole, remember the Central Arizona, you know, grouping, all of that. And yet I'd look at the bankers and say, I can show you how in a budget that won't work. And yet you're telling me that you won't lend me money on vegetables, but you'll lend me money for the cotton. And it was really interesting to go through that cycle with the lenders. And so, fascinating to me to this day that they would have locked me into a business that I think would have gone out of business by now. That model, you know, wouldn't have worked. And yet here I was looking at them saying, let me show you something that's newer, and it's being done. You know, it's not like it's new. You know, it was new to these lenders, I think, but let me show you something that really does have a chance for succeeding. And so we got one lender that believed in us, and so we moved forward, and you know, it worked. And so we went into melons during the summer, potatoes, broccoli, cabbage. So literally, people always ask me, let me share this with you. People always ask me, what do you grow? What do you grow? What do you want to grow? And I always look at everybody and just say, you know, I can tell you today what we grow, but if you ask me tomorrow, it may be just something different. They're like, well, what do you mean? You know, don't you grow the same thing all the time? And I looked at them and said, I'm going to grow whatever I can sell. And that may be totally different tomorrow, because I can tell you what I'm doing today is totally different than what I was doing not too long ago. And so I hope that we are sharp enough, that we are observant enough to identify the opportunities and take advantage of the opportunities, or work our way through the challenges that then creates opportunities. But to be able to recognize opportunities, I think that's significant, you know. And so we went with, at the time, what we thought would make money. And so it was fresh fruits and vegetables and a little bit of cotton. And then we slowly did away with the cotton. It just didn't work in our rotation as far as the agronomics and everything about it. So we went to fresh fruits and vegetables. About that time, we opened the farm to the public, and Kathleen had, I want to say, 25,000 students a year coming through the farm on educational tours. We had festivals, parties. Basically, the farm became a way to share the farm with everybody. There were so many people that didn't, still to this day, don't have an idea as to what farming is about. And I, by that, let me, the example I give is always the U-Pick garden. So we thought, let me tell you, we thought we were, because our open to the public portion of the farm is kind of what we're known for, even though it had to close in 2002.
Some people told me about it, so it is still a legend.
And it was so fun. God, you talk about the great people, wonderful people that we had the opportunity to work with. Anyway, Kathleen built an absolutely phenomenal program. She took a corner of the farm and turned it into an educational and entertaining place. And I say those two things because we found out that if you can make something entertaining and educational at the same time, it has a much greater value to people. And a farm can be that, like that. There, so as an example, the pick your own, because we thought we were selling vegetables. When we opened the farm to the public, we thought we were selling fresh fruits and vegetables. They're right in your backyard. They're going to taste better. They're fresh. That's why you should come and buy your fresh fruits and vegetables from us. Could not have been more wrong. Here we are in Arizona, where basically 90% of, you know, all of the greens for the country come out of here during the winter. We get pretty fresh stuff here, so it's not that big of a deal. And you know, the fruits during the summer, it's just not that big of a deal because we're in Arizona. But we just thought that people wanted that, because people always said, well, God, we'd love to buy your stuff. Why can't we find your stuff? And so we thought we were selling vegetables. So we had this amazingly beautiful, I mean, literally people would come in and take pictures of the wet rack that we had with all the fresh fruits and vegetables that we were growing. And because it's yours, right? And because you have one person in the market, and that's their job, is to make sure that thing is, it's full all the time. And I mean, it was beautiful. It was literally take a picture of it, you know, hang it up on the wall kind of thing. But people would walk in, mom and dad and 2.1 kids, and they'd walk in and go, oh, you harvested the carrots. We thought we'd be able to dig our own. It's like, so you know, I'm dumb, but I'm not an idiot. So after a while, we're kind of looking at each other going, they don't want us to pick this stuff for them. All of this right here can go away. We're literally just the demonstration gardens. We've got this other place right out here. We'll let them go pick it. And so we had the U-Pick gardens, and it never ceases to amaze me to this day how little people know about what they buy in the store every day. So the example I always use is broccoli. So you plant a little bit of broccoli each week so that when it's time to harvest, it doesn't all come on at the same time. It keeps coming out each week, right? So you have to have same amount of broccoli each week. So everything that we grew out there was done that way. So right next to each other, you had these small planted areas where here's this week's harvest, and then next week's is right next to it, and next to that is the following week, and so forth. So on this one area, you have these beautiful broccoli florets.
Continuation of an interview with Mr. Duncan. So we were talking a little bit about the farm becoming, you were using the role of education and recreation, you said.
Yeah.
You were telling that story.
Yeah, I was telling you a story about the broccoli. So we actually had to get to the point where, it's funny, you know, so we had these areas where there's absolutely beautiful, you know, 6-inch beautiful florets on the broccoli but people kept wandering off into the wrong areas, you know, so when, you know, you get kids and even dogs and things like that running, you know, there's a lot of destruction and they just don't get that. So we cordoned them off. This area not ready yet. So we'd put arrows, you know, pick here, not there, pick here. And so it was really funny. And so once again, we use broccoli as the example, but people didn't know what broccoli florets were. So instead of harvesting the ripe, ready ripe broccoli, they would look across the little yellow taped off area, disregard the pick here arrow, and go into where the broccoli was an inch in diameter, an inch and a half in diameter, and they would go ahead, you know, because we just told people to go out to the U-Pick, right? And you could fill your bag. And they'd pick half a bag full of broccoli at 1 inch in diameter, which had you allowed that to get to full size would have been half a pickup load, you know? And so they just wiped out that, you know, what would have been maybe three weeks later, now we have nothing. And so we had to try and find a way to educate people. And so we actually had to have people out there to show people how to harvest things. And it was at a foundational level kind of sad that people didn't know that. You know, we all in the food industry kind of jokingly refer to broccoli as trees. But some people hear that and they think that broccoli comes from trees. And they're looking around for the broccoli trees. We've actually had people ask for broccoli trees. And so, you know, we can laugh about it, but at some level, it is kind of sad. But that's sort of why the farm opened to the public out of frustration too, strangely. Frustration with going to my wife. I already tell you how wonderful she is. Yeah. Anyway,
you can tell us again though.
She was in early childhood education, her job with the state of Arizona through DES and DDD development. Anyway, early childhood education. Her job was in Maricopa County to find programs for children 0 to 5 who were challenged. And so we went two different directions in the morning. And so at one point in time, we decided that, and this was a really long story, but literally just consolidated into one sentence where we decided to blend our careers. And so she created the educational programs on the farm, and it was to have someone so talented and so passionate about what she does create something at a farm that isn't just educational but entertaining and safe, because she redesigned the corner of the farm. I mean, literally, if you think about running along a fence and rubbing your hand along the fence, you know, all the fences had to be sanded so that you couldn't get a sliver. Something as simple as that. She literally would look at everything, and because of where she came from, where kids got hurt in the strangest ways, that she saw the worst case scenario in every situation, and we would correct it when we could. We would correct it. So anyway, when we would go to lunches, dinners with her friends, and they found out that I was a farmer, it was a mixed reaction. Some people's reaction was really one of, oh, you're the guys who are poisoning us with the pesticides. And so I got to the point where, you know, I just sort of absorbed that and then look back at them and say, so you could continue to believe that, which is fine, or would you really like to know? And usually that person would say, I'd love to know. And if they hesitated, someone else at the table usually said, I don't know about her or him, but I'd love to hear. I'm curious. What is the real story about what's going on? So we would talk about farming, and I just say, you know, it's just amazing to me how little people know about farming. And so I get it. You're afraid of what you don't know about, because I'm afraid of things that I don't know about, or at least I'm curious and wonder about them. And so I used to go and give talks to labor groups, to regulatory agencies, to, for some reason, people invited me to talk to them. And so I remember being at one meeting and saying, come out to the farm. Just come out. And you know where regulatory agencies will call in advance and kind of warn you that they're coming out? Don't call me. Just come out. Just show up. Just show up that day. Call me and say, hey, are you busy in an hour? We'd like to come and see the farm. I'll show you around. If we're doing something wrong, we'll correct it. And I'm sure that we're doing a few things wrong, but I think on the other hand, you're going to be amazed at what we are doing. And so people called me and they said, were you serious about that offer? And I said, yeah, we'd like to come out. I said, when will you be here? And they said, you're serious about literally just have, you don't need to go and like have a few days to hide things. And I said, I don't even know what I would hide. Come out. If you've got time this morning, come on out. I'll take the time. And if you guys don't mind checking fields with me, I'll show you around what we do. Let's have an open discussion. Ask me what you want to know. And you can only meet so many people, you know, one truckload at a time, right? So we opened the farm to the public. We wanted to educate people at so many levels, you know, children about nutrition, even our own family about nutrition and where to get things and how to harvest them and how to, you know, just where they're grown. That, yeah, you can, this broccoli right here is probably, you know, that truck. So kids got to go out in the field and literally harvest broccoli, which doesn't require a knife, which is why we chose broccoli. They could just snap it off with their little hands and put it in their bag. And what is so cool is that these kids came out with a preloaded concept of what they knew about. I mean, they knew what they knew about broccoli. They didn't like broccoli. In fact, I could always tell when the tour guide would tell the kids they're going out to get broccoli, because you'd hear the bus going by and you'd hear this ew, you know, as the bus is driving by, and every child was reacting to the information that, oh God, we're going to get broccoli. And then they get out there and they start picking their broccoli and they eat broccoli in the field, and it's, wow, it's actually really good. So they're eating broccoli and then they pick the broccoli and they take it home, and now it's their broccoli. So they go home, and they, it's like the first little fish you caught, right? When you were a kid, and that thing could have been 4 inches long, and you take it home, and you want mom to prepare it that night for dinner, because it's your fish. Well, they had their broccoli. So they take it home, and they want mom or dad to prepare it that night, because it's their broccoli. And we started getting letters from parents and teachers who were saying, wow, you just converted my kid. Now we go to the store, and every broccoli there has got to be yours, so we're going to buy your broccoli. And we're taking it home, and we're probably cooking it that night, because they've been to that field and picked the broccoli, probably in the plant right next to the one that we're about to eat now. But they had a whole different association with not just the farm, but their food. And you bridge that gap. And for us, that was really rewarding, hugely rewarding. And we hear from people to this day. We've been closed for over 10 years. You know, it's 2015 now, so we've been closed for 13 years. And we still hear from people who say, I loved your farm. I used to go to your farm when I was a kid, and I loved that place. I loved going there more than Disneyland. It's like, okay, wait, you're kind. All right. But to think that we contributed in some way to, you know, healthy lifestyles, that's fantastic. Fantastic.
Tell me about bridging that gap from farm to table with the children, and why that's so important even to this day.
It was important to go to the field, you know, not just have a table where the broccoli was sitting. We went out to the field, and they would get literally in an area where we had already harvested, which actually, ironically enough, kind of opened things up a little bit so that it was easier for the kids to walk through there. And we could see them all the time, you know, back to safety, right? We could see them at all times. And they could see the harvest taking place. So they saw the harvester, they saw the tractors, they saw the broccoli being cut, trimmed, placed on a table, and in the table that's on the harvester, that they saw people packing that broccoli and putting it in a box, and the box sliding out on a conveyor to the trailer, where it was then stacked on a pallet, and the trailer driving out to the end of the field and leaving the field, and we kind of help them, you know, in their imaginations, bridge that gap of, okay, that trailer now, that trailer is going to another trailer that looks very similar to that, and that broccoli is going to the stores downtown. And a percentage of it was going right downtown Phoenix. It wasn't in our name, but it was going there. And those kids bridged that all the way through. And it was other things, other aspects of the farm too, because to me, and it was really interesting, because while you think that all of our educational tours were given to people who were basically 4 feet and under, they weren't. It was fantastic. We had postgraduate programs from Thunderbird come out, from ASU, from U of A, from high schools, because on a farm, biology, chemistry, this is where the rubber hits the road, man, out here. You want to talk about any of that stuff? I'll tell you how. Your biology class, here's how it's working here every day. And then to make it age appropriate. So back to the 4 foot and unders. We had an earthworm tunnel that we created with a grant from Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, and it was fantastic. So, in essence, you have to use your imagination, but you're basically walking underneath this cement structure that this sort of. So we took some large trees and, you know, put these large trees and bent them over this what basically was an upside down pool, or what today would look like Fred Flintstone's house. But it was, so as the tour guides were going into this thing, you could enter it, and what you saw were soil profiles hanging on the wall that would describe kind of, here's a kind of a classic Arizona soil profile, which would show you the different colors and textures of the different layers of the soil as they've been laid out, you know, 5 to 6 feet deep, and then compare that to one out of the Midwest or something like that. And then to have the earthworms that when you come around and you get inside, so you're under the soil, you could see the earthworms, and we would take and grind our office paperweight waste, and we'd dump it into the earthworms, add a little water to it, throw a little more compost on top, and man, you'd see it just start moving, you know. And so the kids got to see the earthworms actually with their earthworm tunnels, and sometimes, you know, if the timing was right, we could throw the paper in there, and they'd start eating it. So they saw this activity under the soil. And then we'd turn around and we'd show them. So we had the Phoenix Zoo helped us put it together. Phoenix Zoo and the Arizona Desert Museum outside of Tucson, they all helped us put this place together, this very special place together, and they all played a special role. In fact, if this looks like a real snake, the guys at the Arizona Desert Museum built that for me, made that for me. And so snakes use burrows under the ground along with toads. So, I mean, you put that guy out there and it looks fairly real, looks extremely real. In fact, I've had people freak out when they see the snake on my desk. So I forget about these things. So, you know, there was this example, these different examples of tunnels and holes and what essentially what the soil looks like if you had the opportunity to be underground. And so at this level, at this level being, you know, inches below the soil surface, and then, oh, by the way, there were roots that were coming down through the surface, because what we were telling the kids to use their imagination, and that imagine a huge tree has blown over in a massive storm, and this root ball has pulled up, and then in that storm the water kind of raced underneath and created this little area where you could get in underneath the soil and see what it looks like. And kids are fantastic with their imagination, so they could see this. They were there in their minds. They're under the soil looking at the earthworms digesting the paper waste, and looking at these very lifelike figurines and where they would be in the soil, and the roots coming down through the top of the ceiling and everything, and so they're kind of ducking as they move through, and it's kind of an eerie place, and so there's flashlights where we could, you know, shine the light, because there's no light in there except for the light that the tour guide had, and so they could identify these areas specific to, you know, what they wanted the kids to be focusing on. And so at the end of the tour, basically kids got to understand that the soil is a living medium, and that there are as many microorganisms living in literally one small clod of soil that there are people on the earth. So they would kind of say, so when you go out and you look at that clod, there's living organisms in there as many as people are on the earth. In fact, animals and humans on the earth. And you'd see these kids walking out and looking at a dirt clod, picking it up, and instead of throwing it, they'd place it gingerly back down on the ground because they got it. They get it. The soil is a living medium that we require. We live with all of these organisms, and they help us and we help them. And that's where you sort of bridge that really nerdy science end to the farm again. But that's also how the rubber hits the road as far as the science that we learn in grade school, high school, and then certainly the application of that science into a business format. How does that look to postgraduate people who are interested in that as well? So we had everybody of all ages coming out and all levels of education coming out, and it was fantastic.
Tell me kind of the most memorable moment you had when the kids, like you said, they got it, especially the 4 foot and under, when they got it after they've been on the farm for a
day. Sometimes it's the most simplistic. I'll never forget being on the yard and seeing a bus arrived, and the little kids came piling out, and they ran right over to the petting zoo, which we had a petting zoo, because a vegetable farm is not allowed to exist without, you can't have a farm without animals. So basically everybody's, so we had a vegetable farm. We started inviting people out to the vegetable farm, and they're like, where are the animals? Well, it's a vegetable farm. So, do we have a problem here? And basically the teachers are saying, yeah, we kind of expected a farm. It's like, well, this feels like a farm to us. But no, we really did realize that everybody's perception of the farm is basically the front cover of Charlotte's Web, where, you know, yeah, you've got the spider web in the corner, you know, the entrance to the barn, but you've got the horse leaning over the freshly painted fence talking to the goose, and you see the pig in the background. You've got the red barn, the white silo, you know, the silo and the house with the white picket fence. And so we sort of needed to meet people's expectations along those lines. And so we did. And so we're going to get into another story at some point in time about that petting zoo. But when I saw the kids come running over, you know, I just thought, well, you know, I got a little bit of time. So I went over and I was leaning up against the fence, and the kids came running up, and the first teacher, who rightfully kind of jogged across, you know, to be there, you know, where the kids were so that they don't, you know, get in trouble or whatever. So the teacher and I are leaning across the fence, you know, I introduce myself and we're looking at the animals, and a little girl came running up and she said, oh, teacher, look at the cow, as she's looking at a little potbelly pig. And I looked at the teacher, and she said, there's a reason why we're here. And I was like, wow, okay. I didn't realize we had that much of a gap here. That one kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. And so you asked me what was my reaction. I'll never forget that one. I said, okay, I get it. This is, wow, this is education at a foundational level, isn't it? And she said, it absolutely is. And that's why we love coming here every year. She said, son, I think this is my, I can't remember what year, and she just said, this is fantastic. I said, I'll be sure to tell Kathleen that, thank you. And Kelly, because we had, you know, Kelly McGuire, who became our tour guide, the head of our tour guide. So we ended up with, I want to say, like 10 part-time people who were leading tours. Just incredible people. People who were retired and spending their winters out here, who just enjoyed kids. And so they'd come out and they'd teach. And they were just the most awesome people that we got to know. And when you get to work with people who are doing things because it's just fun to them, God, it's amazing, you know, all the ideas that come out and just the wonderful programs that you can create. So anyway, I digress. Please.
So tell me about the decision to close and how hard that was and how sad it was for your family.
Oh, it was, it's tough to go back to that time, but we had to close because of activities at Luke Air Force Base, where it was deemed inappropriate, if not unsafe, then inappropriate for large numbers of students to be underneath the, what is now referred to as the Southern Departure Corridor. After 9/11, after 9/11, the Air Force started training in earnest. And by that I mean they started practicing with more live ammunition. And since there had been so much development out the other end of the runway to the northeast, all live ammunition sorties were going to take off to the southwest at all times of the day. And regardless of whether there was a 10-mile-per-hour tailwind or not, because the reason that they always took off to the northeast in the morning was to take off into a headwind. So we didn't have the noise. We didn't have the activity. And so when they turned around and started coming over the top of us, you know, we started asking, and then they found out, you know, who we were, what we were. And anyway, regardless of the details of it, it was deemed unsafe to have that many students. You know, we had at any given time 600 to 900 students on the grounds at any one time. And so literally larger than some schools. And so it was best that we not be there. And so we had to close. It was an incredibly difficult decision, emotional for everybody. It was at a time also when we had worked so hard for so many years to actually make it be sustainable, where it was economically sustainable for the first time, literally after 10 years. And so for everyone's ideas and programs and hard work to never feel that fulfillment of the ultimate of success, they were cheated out of that. They were cheated out of the, not us, they were cheated out of the job that they loved going to every morning. It was a blast. You know, it was really fun. It still is. I mean, I love farming, but that was a lot of fun, you know, and we still hear about it today. So it was difficult. It was difficult. It was the right thing. I'll never question that. It was the right thing to do. But it was difficult. You're right.
Do you miss the kids?
Yeah. Yeah. I miss the kids. I miss the people. I miss the programs. I miss the newness. I miss being that close to the people who could let you know what you're, you know, when you get that close, when you're able to sell vegetables and to people, they tell you what they like and they don't like. And so you're never closer. People that go to farmers markets are never closer. I think retailers would love to know what people that sell at farmers markets, what growers know about what people want, what they're willing to buy, what they're willing to pay for. And they may want to, or they may not want people to know, you know, why things are priced certain ways, you know, because that can be too much information, shall we say. But I loved the feedback, the direct feedback that we got. We learned so much about what people need and what they want. And I have to tell you that I'd prefer to sell things that people really want versus what they need. Because someone will pay anything for what they want and try to work you down to the lowest price on things that they absolutely need. Because they got to have it. So we just, and it's just funner, you know, to sell, to work with people and at a level where they want something and are having fun with it.
So let's talk about the move to go to organic, to certified organic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So remember the whole thing about, you know, the motto of better to be lucky than good? So we got into organics pretty much by accident. We got into composting pretty much by accident. And one leads to the other. So we opened the farm to the public. And while it was going to be about educational tours and that's it, when parents and chaperones and teachers and bus drivers and everybody started coming out, they're looking at this place going, I want to have my child's birthday party here, or we want to do this here, you know, could you have a festival would be great. So we erroneously started down the road of trying to be all things to all people. And so we did have, you know, festivals, we had birthday parties, and so we'll just end it at festivals. But with the first festival, we throw this festival and we have no seating anywhere. So we talked about what we could do, and we took a bunch of straw bales from barley that we had on the farm, and we took those straw bales and we made seating around all over the place. So we created a little stage. We had seating for the entertainment. We had seating around trees. We created with the bales. We created a little maze for the kids to go through. It was really neat. And obviously, if they got stuck, they could just climb out. So that was easy. Yeah. And for Kathleen, that was great because you could always see the kids. They were never out of sight. So we have these bales. And it just so happened that it was a very wet winter. And so we have these straw bales that are out. And after the festival, and I can't remember which festival it was or what the reason was. But anyway, we decided just leave the bales out there. You know, why not? We'll use them. There's seating now for, you know, the different school groups that are coming out. But then it rained, and rained some more, and rained a little bit after that. And the bales got so wet, kind of like a really large sponge, that there's a certain amount of seed that gets packed into the straw bales from the barley. So that seed started to grow out the top. It germinated with the moisture from the rains, and it literally would rain like every 4 days. And so it was perfect germinating moisture. The barley grew up, got to be 4 or 5 inches tall, and Kathleen, you know, I come into the office, she's saying, hey, I think you could do something about those bales, you know, that we can't really use them very much right now because they're growing. And so I'm looking at the bales going, oh, yeah, that happens. She's going, yeah, I didn't know that was going to happen. And I'm looking at her going, well, I didn't know it was going to rain. And so we went out and just flipped them over, and they dried out on the bottom, and everything was fine until it rained again. Which was, I don't know, about 5-6 days later, it just kept raining. So sure enough, what happens, the bottom now starts to grow because, you know, it gets warm, sunny in between the rains a little bit. And so, you know, it gets a little bit of, it's got the moisture, it's getting some warmth, it germinates as well. So now we've got the stuff that we rotated down below, it's moist, the stuff that's up on top and the stuff that's down below is, and the bale itself are kind of starting to rot, so things are starting to get a little ripe around there. And so we have that classic conversation of, honey, is there any way? I was like, yeah, we got to get rid of this because this thing smells bad, even in the office. So we went, and I mean, each of these things now, these bales weigh like 300 or 400 pounds a piece. I mean, they weigh a ton. And so we hauled them all out in back. And we throw them into this pile. And recently we have found out that, you know, our vegetable farm was supposed to have animals on it. So we started the petting zoo. So we clean the petting zoo every morning. And so we had this place out in back where this pile of stuff from the petting zoo was. And so we just threw the wet, soggy bales on top of that, pulled all the string and wire out of it and just stacked it up on that. And, and then we just kept throwing, every morning, we just keep throwing the manure from, and anything that we cleaned out of the petting zoo on that. And then it rained again. And then Kathleen came to me and said, hey, you know where we put that new garden in? We're going to bring the kids in from this direction and then take them this other place. So can you move that pile it doesn't have to move very far. Can you just move it a little bit, you know, one way? And so, I didn't expect that.
I can stop. Today is August 7th, 2015. My name is Christina Varro-McLean, interviewing for Arizona State University, dinner 2440. I'm asking you to, interviewing Mr. Arnett Duncan.
Arnett.
Duncan, can you spell your first name?
Sure, it's A-R-N-O-T-T.
Okay.
And Duncan is D-U-N-C-A-N.
Thank you. And then could I ask you your title as well and the organization that you work for, Borough?
So I work with a lot of really neat people at Duncan Family Farms, just west of Phoenix, about 30 miles west of Phoenix, in Goodyear, Arizona.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your background and how your family got into farming.
Okay. So my biological father passed when I was 4 or 5. My mom remarried when I was 8 or 9. And so my dad, since I was young enough, my stepfather is my dad. So he is the third generation farmer. His family actually homesteaded in Arizona, the southwest corner of what is now 7th Avenue and Southern in South Phoenix. And so I grew up as a little kid going out to the farm, you know, all summers, weekends, holidays, really any time that we were needed, and we were pretty much needed all the time. And I just loved it. You know, back then the farm was that classic Central Arizona cotton, you know, forages, cereal grains, and, you know, an odd little, you know, seed variety here or there that you would try. But for the most part, we didn't do any vegetables. My dad did a few watermelons here and there because that's kind of what he grew up doing when he was in high school. Anyway, that was our first foray into vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables, was watermelons. And so my dad came by that, you know, years ago when he was in high school. I was going to say when all the men went off to war, World War II, there weren't enough guys around to harvest, and so he organized his high school buddies, mostly football players, and they went and harvested watermelons. And so that just stuck with my dad, and so, shoot, he grew melons for decades.
So tell me what it was about the farm and going out and working it, and you enjoyed it, but also, you know, kind of, you were young and it was hot and it was hard. Can you explain kind of...
You know, it's funny. Looking back, you know, if you looked at what we did today, looking back, given today's regulations, present age, obviously, you know, now that I'm in my late 50s, you know, I look back on what we did and just am amazed at some of the things that we did, and you just learn so much from being out on the farm frequently on your own with, you know, you with your... I was with my brother and my cousins. We're all about the same age. And, you know, our first jobs on the farm were basically cutting weeds, digging ditches, you know, the romantic part of farming. And it was just, you know, but lunchtimes and of course any of our breaks that we would take, we probably weren't tired. We just wanted to play. But we took breaks, and sometimes, you know, if the lizard got away from you, it took a lot longer to take that break than another one. But we had fun out on the farm. We learned to drive. We learned to drive tractors first. We learned to drive tractors before we could reach the pedals, and it wasn't as necessary to reach the pedals. My dad would just move the seat back on the tractor. There was a hand clutch on the John Deere tractor, and so you could kind of scoot around to hit the brake on the left side while you were working the clutch with your hand. And so you learn to do things and become, I guess, self-supporting. I guess it's a pretty good place to just learn how to do things. And in doing that, things that we thought were just average every day, friends that we went to school with, because I grew up in downtown Phoenix. You know, when I was... young guy, we lived on about 32nd Street in Oak, and so we just drove out to the farm. It was just fun growing up on the farm. The things that we did that our buddies downtown, you know, just were amazed that we could drive, you know. And I started driving cars and trucks when I was a little guy too, you know, and really trying to get, you know, to the pedals and everything. There were times when, you know, the old thick telephone book came into play frequently. So anyway, it was fun. It was fun. And then on top of just being a kid out on a farm without a lot of rules, there was this attraction to the outdoors. And I couldn't put my finger on it. Even when I got into college, I didn't know then, my first year in college, you know, I was always attracted to the natural sciences in high school. I didn't have that opportunity to do the 4-H or FFA. I went to Catholic grade schools. I went to Brophy Prep. So, You know, when buddies in agriculture would say, hey, remember in FFA when we did this? And it's like, yeah, no, I don't. But I always enjoyed the natural sciences. And when I got to my freshman year at the University of Arizona in Tucson, I wanted to be in agriculture. I wanted to be working outside. Here we sit in my office, but this isn't the place that brings me joy. It's walking fields. It's being out working the land, I guess. And it's just, it's kind of funny when people ask me today, what are you going to do? When are you going to retire? And, you know, I think classic farmers I don't know that we ever retire, really. You know, you just slow down a little bit. But my answer is kind of a patent, just a, you know, I see myself as an agronomic consultant to my own company after I get out of everybody's way, you know, because they're these guys that are coming up in the company are so sharp, they're dedicated, they come preloaded with so much really cool information, that yeah, at some point in time I'll be getting out of their way and just hopefully still able to contribute at a level, and I know I'll always be able to enjoy the farm, so. You know, hopefully they'll be patient with me and let me hang around.
So let's talk a little bit about the work ethic you learned working on the farm and growing up on the farm. Kind of, how has that played a role in your life today?
Wow. You learn that hard work is just what everybody should do. You know, it's just, hard work isn't that difficult. If when you do it every day, it's just not that difficult. And then when you see today, to this day, I have a respect for people who work hard, who actually appreciate the art of agriculture or plumbing or electronics or carpentry or whatever it is. There's an artistry to that, and I appreciate that at every level. And to this day, you know, we have wonderful people that we get to work with, you know, at an entry level position on the farm, and I like to go around and go out and sometimes, like over in one of the California farms, we have rocks everywhere. We had to pick up rocks because they were literally killing the equipment, and the only way we could do that. At that point in time, anyway, was literally just walk out with our hands and pick them up and throw them in a trailer. And so I remember going by, still to this day, whenever I see a rock crew, you know, I want to go out, walk out and shake their hands and say, thank you for doing this. I know this is a hellish task. Thanks for doing this. And they're looking at me like, hey, what are you talking about? This is what we do. You know, you're paying us to do this. We do this. You know, we're good. And I just want them to know. No, I appreciate you being here. You can do anything for this price. You can do anything anywhere. And I just want you to know that I appreciate you doing this here today. And I'm sure that as I'm driving off, they're going, so who was that guy, anyway? But it just gives you an appreciation for the value of what everybody does. So. Hard work is hard work. I mean, I have to tell you a story. My older son went to work with his uncle for a couple of weeks in a large food service venue, a country club of some sort. And so, you know, Kel was kind of interested in that industry at the time. And so, you know, his uncle said, hey, come on out, take a look at it, see what you think. So, you know, I'm sure he probably started washing dishes, you know, bussing tables here and there, just doing what anybody can do, just stepping off the street. And so he'd go in early in the morning and, you know, work his hours, clean up from the night before, whatever that looked like. And I'll never forget that he called me up the next day after work and he said, hey, I talked to my brother-in-law, his uncle. He called me up and he said, hey, I want to share with you an interaction that one of my one of my supervisors just had with Cal. He said, you'll get a kick out of this. So he goes on to explain that Kel had come in early, worked all morning, stayed a little later to kind of help prep for something, and then they had a few people not show up for what was a large gala event that night. And so they looked at Kel, the supervisor looks at Kel and just says, Kel, would you even consider, you know, helping serve tonight? And he said, sure. You know, just point to where I go, what I do, and sure, I'll do it. And so they gave him his white coat and gloves or whatever it was. And he stays that night late into the evening and works all night, helps clean up, and then shows up early the next day, which by that time is probably maybe 4 hours later or something. Shows up to work and starts doing what he normally does. And the supervisor came in, made a point of coming in to mention to my brother-in-law that Kel, when she went to Kel to say, wow, that was incredible. I mean, the fact that you literally worked all day was just amazing. And what the report from my brother-in-law was, so Kel, right off the bat, looks at her and says, oh, wait, you think that was hard work? Oh, no. Packing watermelons at 113 degrees, you know, for 8.5 to 10.5 hours a day, that's work. This, I can do this all the time. So if that gives you an indication as to, you know, the level of appreciation that you have in just learning how to work hard, I think Kel explained it pretty well.
He absolutely did. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of the...
And so you get an idea that I don't have a problem telling you things. In fact, you're going to have to shut me up when I get into the story.
I'm not going to. So I have as much time as you do today. So my schedule's open. And it's a great story. So that's perfect. Tell me a little bit about the harvesting of the vegetables and the family, you know, dinner table and what that was like, kind of that interaction between your family and cooking and...
So, interestingly, when the boys were little, when I have two boys, 2.5 boys. The half is that because I know you're thinking, well, what is that? The half is a young man came to us when he was 14 or 15, his freshman year in high school. He was on the freshman basketball team with my younger son, Sean. And his, for lack of a better definition, his family, his home situation kind of imploded. And so, actually maybe exploded. So he didn't have anywhere to go. So my younger son invited him to come home and spend the night and... you know, get dinner or whatever. And so, you know, he came over and we got to meet. Javier is the young man's name. And so we got to meet Javi. And so basketball starts and Kathleen's, you know, bringing Javi, you know, the freshman team, they get to go last. They're last. They're low on the totem pole. So anyway, Kathleen goes to take Hav home one night, and there's just police caution tape around the entire house. And make a long story short, there was his most of his family was in jail, and his younger sister had been taken away. He had no idea where, but there was no one to talk to. The neighbors just said, everybody's gone. And so Javi spent the night. And so we washed his clothes, got him a toothbrush, and he was good to go to school the next day, but he couldn't find anything out about where he was supposed to go, stay, whatever. Everybody was in jail. So he spent the night again. And then he spent another night. And then he spent another night. And, you know, my wife Kathleen, who is, let me just say this, it's always better to really marry well. She is absolutely the better half. She took Javi out and just said, you know, why don't you, would it be easier to stay with us if you had a little bit of clothing? Because he couldn't get any clothing out of the house was shut down. So we bought some clothes, probably got some deodorant, some, you know, whatever else those guys need when they're freshmen in high school, we got that stuff. And so the half started. And so we have 2.5 boys. But anyway, when the original two, Kel and Sean, were little guys, we decided to open the farm up to the public. And that was in the early 90s. And so you talk about dinner around the table. And so it was really fun, you know, to have the boys out on the farm, right? Because they're little guys and they're cruising around on the farm and they were catching toads and chasing lizards and all the stuff that I did, and they were having a ball. But I'll never forget our younger son, who was, two at the time, two something. And Kathleen had gone to get a pizza, and she pulls down the tailgate of the truck, you know, we dive into our juice and pizza, and Sean says, "Mom, are we ever going to have dinner at our table again?" And she looks at me. I almost half choked on the pizza, and it was like, okay, so we might be spending a little too much time at the farm here. How do we back off? And so we just, you know, we made a point of starting to have dinner time and making a point of you know, not sitting in front of the TV, but sitting down with each other at the same table and having dinner. And what was really interesting is I enjoy those moments so much that, and it's a joke in the family, that I put my fork down, maybe take a drink of milk or water or whatever, and I just sit and kind of look around the table and just sort of take it all in. And so Sean, the same younger son, same guy, says, "You know, Pops, it's a little creepy that you just put your fork down and kind of just stare at us for a little bit." He said, "I get it, it's kind of cool, you're just enjoying the moment, but it's a little creepy." And so after we all stopped laughing, I just said, "I absolutely love these moments, and you're right. I would just freeze this right now if I could, you know, and I'd look at those guys and just say, I'd like to freeze you right where you're at too, because this, you guys are just so fun all the time." And they're just like, they just hit you, you know, and just go, yeah, right, Pops. So dinner was just time with family, you know. So breakfast and dinner, I didn't have lunch with them. And I got to the point where I'd start to go into work just a little bit later, just so that I could have breakfast with them before they went to school, so that I could see them twice a day. I'd get to see them in the morning and get to see them at night. And I'd stay at work a little bit later, but I'd still get them at night and in the day. And to me, that was twice as much time. And I think it was the same with them. But I'll never know, because I'm not going to ask them. But to me, it was a significant thing.
What do you think happens at the dinner table that makes it so important, it makes you enjoy those moments so much?
Stories. Stories about what you did during the day. And you know, for us, I got to tell you know, when they were that age, it wasn't so much about the preparation of the food or anything. And oh my God, and when they got older, it definitely was not about the preparation of the food, because as they grew, they're 6'5 and 6'4, Javi's 6 or 6'1, and their friends, we had the, you know, the Kool-Aid house, if you will. So all their friends, and we loved it. We wanted to have that house where everybody came. You know, we wanted the house that everybody came to, because we loved knowing what they were up to, you know, and just enjoyed that time with them so much. But honestly, I'll never forget Kathleen running back into the back room one time, just going, "You got to come out and help me." She's going, "I literally cannot prepare food fast enough to get in front of these guys I just they're starving. You know, there's no chunks out of the furniture yet, but you know, you gotta give me a hand here. The microwave isn't fast enough. So I went out and here's, you know, part of the basketball team, some guys from the baseball team, football team, and they're all big. They're all big guys. And they were just tearing through the food. And so I have to admit that, you know, when in their formative ages, shall we say, they probably weren't eating the best stuff around. Just massive quantities of it, you know, as they're tearing through, you know, huge numbers of calories every day as they're lifting in the morning, running, and then, you know, open gym or whatever the season, you know, looked like. So, yeah, we were just trying to keep those guys, you know, full. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I digress.
No, it's great, it's perfect.
So today, let me share with you, today is so funny because just the other day, so now, you know, especially when we're in season here in Arizona, you know, now it's you know, I harvest things and I take them home and you know, we juice a lot. The boys juice. They love doing the juicing thing. We do a lot of juicing for breakfast and even to drink with lunch and maybe dinner. But, you know, for Kathleen and I, dinner is a large bowl of salad with different ingredients. But then the entree, you know, fish, chicken usually will be on top. And that's dinner. And then we usually eat out of the same bowl, you know, handing it back and forth and carrying on conversations about what she's doing, what I'm doing, what the boys are doing, and you know, visiting about friends and just that's dinner. But it's basically a salad with something on top. And that just seems very natural to us. But I can't remember which one of our boys it was. I think it was Sean was over the other day. And he's looking, kind of rummaging through the refrigerator really quick, and he's going, "Mom, you don't have anything to eat in here. The only thing I see is there's just ingredients." And so we just loved that statement so much, because you know, and yet he enjoys good healthy meals with us, but at that moment he just wanted that thing to throw in the microwave. Because he had a short period of time and, you know, to have lunch or whatever it was, he needed to get going. So anyway, that's dinner for us. Or those are meals. Meals have been, you know, I guess just whatever time we can get to hang out with each other.
What made you decide to go into the family business? And at what point did you make that decision, do you think?
Oh, I just knew, like I said, well, early on in my academic life, I just knew I wanted to be outside. It was pretty quickly that I transferred that interest of just being outdoors to really wanting to learn about agronomy. So I got my degree in agronomy and plant genetics. I graduated in the early 80s and just went out to the farm, the family farm, and so started working in the family farm and doing that classic Central Arizona, you know, row crop configuration. But there were signals to me that I picked up. I had the opportunity to study some, you know, the sale of commodities. So I studied the commodity market. I actually, you know, bought some futures, you know, and with my dad's blessing and we went in together and we bought and sold cotton so that I could learn how to buy and sell cotton, how to market more efficiently. Because, you know, the easiest thing sometimes in the fresh fruit and vegetable, any crop that you're growing, any part of agriculture, the easiest thing to do is to produce. The most challenging is to market. And so I wanted to learn this thing about cotton marketing. And so it just happened to be at a time in the marketing, in the overall distribution of cotton as a global commodity. It was just shifting from a domestically grown, domestically used commodity to global. And so for the first time, for an example, you'd see a massive hailstorm go through, you know, the cotton belt, and the market didn't budge. And it was earth-shaking. You know, it was, everybody in the room was looking at the reports of potential damage to the cotton crop, and yet there was no movement in the cotton market, in the futures market. What in the world was going on? Unbeknownst to us growers, there were reports that other countries had the ability and wanted to move cotton into the world market. So the world marketers, the world buyers of cotton took that into consideration. And so market didn't budge. The inventory was now out there. And the United States inventory of cotton was just one of many. And so at that point, you start to realize, you know, my immediate reaction was to look at the price of cotton that day and just go, wait, that means we're going to have to grow cotton for this amount? That's not going to happen. So then you realize as a commodity grower that now you're farming the government. And now you play to the whims of the, not to say that it's the whims, but that's, I'm sorry, that's the first word that comes to mind, of the federal government. And so trying to figure out what you're doing every other year, or at the very least every 5 years, extremely challenging. And not only that, I'm a farmer. I like growing crops. I don't want to have to farm the government. That's not what I do. That's not what I get enjoyment out of. So that changed how I looked at farming. It changed how I looked at marketing. So I wanted to get into crops that could stand on their own, where I could put a budget together. And so, by the way, you ought to know that around here we use a lot of sports analogies. So we use the, you know, if you're batting in baseball and you step up and, you know, there's an average of a certain number of certainly strikeouts, walks, singles, doubles, triples, home runs. You know, if you're putting a budget together and it requires you to hit a double or a triple every time you step up to the plate, man, those are tough odds, like almost impossible. But yet that's what we're looking at. So then how do we make money without the government stepping in and saying, oh, hey, let me carry that ball for you and throw it a little further into the field? That was tough. So I wanted to get into something that would allow me to be profitable. And so I really wanted to get into more of the fresh fruits and vegetables. And so we started to do that. And it was right about that time when we first started into, we as a family, my dad, my brothers, we all farmed together at one point in my dad's company, Agricultural Enterprises. And so it was actually right around that time when we realized that we just had very different, we being myself and my brothers and my dad, just had different ways of farming. And what was important to me was maybe not as important to them. And so, you know, with everybody's blessing, Kathleen and I kind of broke off and did our own thing. And so it was sort of a transition that took place in the mid-80s and finished in the late 80s, around 88. And so we started our own farm. And sometimes it's just better to be lucky than good. And we grew mostly vegetables, still growing a little bit of cotton at that time. But we did well enough to keep going. And there were some extremely slim years. There were times when I'd go home and Kathleen and I would grab the boys and we'd look at them and just say, listen, guys, here's where we're at. And to look at really young faces, and to try and let them know that, you know, listen, it's not all lost or anything, but we're going to have to be tight here, you know. So when your buddies come and they've got a new skateboard and you're not able to get one, here's what's up. Here's what's going on. So they learned. They learned early on. You know, you save when you can, and when you'd hit a home run and you'd have a good melon crop or broccoli or whatever potato, whatever that crop might have been, you save it and you wait and you hold on to that and you learn to be conservative. And I think learning to farm on my own during a period when Central Arizona agriculture was not really swinging from the trees so much, it was very difficult. If you could make it at that time, I think you could make it anywhere. And so we learned to farm in those times. And so you really learned to save and budget and be conservative, fiscally conservative. So anyway, so now I've been taken off. What was the original question?
No, that's perfect. So I'm going to follow up with a question about the decision to split up. I mean, what was that impact for you? I mean, personally, I mean, it must have been one of the hardest decisions you made. And how did you make that decision?
Oh, it was really interesting. I'm kind of a systems guy. We also joke about a fairly healthy level of OCD in my family with me, and so there's a lot of funny jokes about that, and I wear that badge somewhat proudly, so I'm good with it. At the very least, I'm good with it. Because at the end of the day, when you're in agriculture, I don't know that having a healthy amount of OCD doesn't help you. You know, pay attention to detail. To create systems of efficiency that help everybody, you know, work together more efficiently and so that you can work smarter and not harder, because that, at the end of the day, I think is what has helped us kind of move forward a little bit. So the decision was Kathleen and I went to have dinner with my folks and I had an idea. So I wanted to meet with my dad, with my parents in general, knowing that there was a chance that this could go, you know, one of two ways. And one was that he would like the idea and move forward with. And the idea was, here's how we can organize this farm so that the brothers aren't overlapping and yet not dropping the ball or creating gaps in between us. So here's how we can organize this so that here's how the literally an organizational chart, flow of personnel, flow of equipment, you know, and I thought I had laid out pretty well, you know, and actually my dad did too. He looked at it and he said, yeah, that'd be great if I wanted to do that. But he just looked at me, he just looked at both Kathleen and I, and he said, I have never wanted you guys to farm together. Never wanted you. That would be the worst idea in the world for you guys to farm together. Because unbeknownst to me, he and his family had tried that, and it didn't work very well. And he didn't want to create that situation that threw us all into the same bucket and tight work environment. He just thought, I'm not going to do that to you. So he just said, I just have always wanted to create an opportunity for you guys to get in here, learn, and then go and do your own thing. And so I'm looking at him going, I guess it's time for me to go do my own thing. And Kathleen kind of grabs my leg and my mom starts crying. And I just said, great. I didn't know that, you know, we might've started a transition a little bit earlier so that it wouldn't be just, hey, tomorrow I'm going to go out and start my own thing now. No, it was great. With their blessing, Kathleen and I, you know, literally jumped off the cliff together, holding, you know, each other's hand. And we joke about those things, not that moment per se, but I have to say, after that, you know, holidays and dinners with my family became a lot more fun, because we weren't, you know, grinding about the farm and what was supposed to have happened that day or did happen or whatever. And so it became less about work and all about family stuff again. So it was good. It was great. And Kathleen and I still joke about the amount of work, because her thought was, you know, that was a big place. And when I got out of school, you know, I thought I'd be able to come in and just turn the agricultural world on its ear, you know, because, hey, I know how to do this stuff, right? And I guess it's good to have self-confidence, but still, that was ridiculous thinking. Because I get out of school and I could have worked, you know, I could have worked 30 hours a day, and that farm could have absorbed every last minute of that. And as I later found out. But when I started, when Kathleen and I were doing our own, you work just as hard, if not harder, but it feels different. It's just different when it's your place. And I think any business owner, any entrepreneur would feel that. Not that I'm an entrepreneur, any individual business owner would feel that when it's your place. There's just a different feeling about it. It just feels right. It feels good. And so you know that every last minute that you put into it is benefiting you and your family and the people that you get to work with, hopefully. And so it's just got to, I don't know, just, you don't get tired. You get physically tired, but you don't get emotionally tired.
So you mentioned that you weren't an entrepreneur, however, you have to manage the business, you have to market, you have to produce. So in some ways you are an entrepreneur in your own right.
Oh, I know, I joke about that, okay. Though. I jokingly go with the motto of, you know, it's better to be lucky than good. And I just think that I've been incredibly lucky in my life.
Do you think your business skills helped you manage and kind of transform the farm itself?
I wouldn't really call myself a great businessman. I think there's a certain amount of logic that goes forward. There's a certain amount of, remember, the respect for people, having a certain level of respect for the people that you work with will get you, you can create good teams, and we had really good teams, still do.
So let's talk a little bit about choosing to start on your own, the crops you chose, why you chose them.
So we chose to go into fresh fruits and vegetables as much as possible, although ironically enough, at the time that we broke away, financing, the financial institutions were set up and organized so much around the guarantee that the government throws, you know, that safety net underneath the commodities, that you could borrow money all day long to grow cotton. And the whole, remember the Central Arizona, you know, grouping, all of that. And yet I'd look at the bankers and say, I can show you how in a budget that won't work. And yet you're telling me that you won't lend me money on vegetables, but you'll lend me money for the cotton. And it was really interesting to go through that cycle with the lenders. And so fascinating to me to this day that they would have locked me into a business that I think would have gone out of business by now. That model, you know, wouldn't have worked. And yet here I was looking at them saying, let me show you something that's newer, and it's being done. You know, it's not like it's new, you know, it was new to these lenders, I think, but let me show you something that really does have a chance for succeeding. And so we got one lender that believed in us. And so we moved forward, and, you know, it worked. And so we went into melons during the summer, potatoes, broccoli, cabbage. So literally, people always ask me, let me share this with you. People always ask me, what do you grow? What do you grow? What do you want to grow? And I always look at everybody and just say, you know, I can tell you today what we grow, but if you ask me tomorrow, it may be just something different. They're like, well, what do you mean? You know, don't you grow the same thing all the time? And I looked at them and said, I'm going to grow whatever I can sell. And that may be totally different tomorrow, because I can tell you what I'm doing today is totally different than what I was doing not too long ago. And so I hope that we are sharp enough, that we are observant enough to identify the opportunities and take advantage of the opportunities, or work our way through the challenges that then creates opportunities. But to be able to recognize opportunities, I think that's significant, you know. And so we went with, at the time, what we thought would make money. And so it was fresh fruits and vegetables and a little bit of cotton. And then we slowly did away with the cotton. It just didn't work in our rotation as far as the agronomics and everything about it. So we went to fresh fruits and vegetables. About that time, we opened the farm to the public, and Kathleen had, I want to say, 25,000 students a year coming through the farm on educational tours. We had festivals, parties. Basically, the farm became a way to share the farm with everybody. There were so many people that didn't, still to this day, don't have an idea as to what farming is about. The example I give is always the U-Pick garden. So we thought, because our open to the public portion of the farm is kind of what we're known for, even though it had to close in 2002.
Some people told me about it, so it is still a legend.
And it was so fun. God, you talk about the great people, wonderful people that we had the opportunity to work with. Anyway, Kathleen built an absolutely phenomenal program. She took a corner of the farm and turned it into an educational and entertaining place. And I say those two things because we found out that if you can make something entertaining and educational at the same time, it has a much greater value to people. And a farm can be that, like that. As an example, the pick your own, because we thought we were selling vegetables. When we opened the farm to the public, we thought we were selling fresh fruits and vegetables. They're right in your backyard. They're going to taste better. They're fresh. That's why you should come and buy your fresh fruits and vegetables from us. Could not have been more wrong. Here we are in Arizona, where basically 90% of, you know, all of the greens for the country come out of here during the winter. We get pretty fresh stuff here. So it's not that big of a deal. And, you know, the fruits during the summer, it's just not that big of a deal because we're in Arizona. But we just thought that people wanted that because people always said, well, God, we'd love to buy your stuff. Why can't we find your stuff? And so we thought we were selling vegetables. So we had this amazingly beautiful, I mean, literally people would come in and take pictures of the wet rack that we had with all the fresh fruits and vegetables that we were growing. And because it's yours, right? And because you have one person in the market and that's their job, is to make sure that thing is full all the time. And I mean, it was beautiful. It was literally take a picture of it, you know, hang it up on the wall kind of thing. But people would walk in, mom and dad and 2.1 kids, and they'd walk in and go, oh, you harvested the carrots. We thought we'd be able to dig our own. It's like, so, you know, I'm dumb, but I'm not an idiot. So after a while, we're kind of looking at each other going, they don't want us to pick this stuff for them. All of this right here can go away. We're literally just the demonstration gardens. We've got this other place right out here. We'll let them go pick it. And so we had the U-Pick gardens, and it never ceases to amaze me to this day how little people know about what they buy in the store every day. So the example I always use is broccoli. So you plant a little bit of broccoli each week so that when it's time to harvest, it doesn't all come on at the same time. It keeps coming out each week, right? So you have to have same amount of broccoli each week. So everything that we grew out there was done that way. So right next to each other, you had these small planted areas where here's this week's harvest, and then next week's is right next to it, and next to that is the following week, and so forth. So on this one area, you have these beautiful broccoli florets